Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes David Linden, Johns Hopkins Professor of Neuroscience and editor of Think Tank, a cutting-edge collection of essays exploring the quirky and counterintuitive aspects of the brain. Linden will be joined by colleagues Dr. Connor and Dr. Bastian. Wednesday, April 25th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop at 6080 Falls Road. For more information, call 410-377-2966 or go to theivybookshop.com. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rogics, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 379. It's Monday, April 23rd, 2018. Today's program is a follow-up to my Sunday column in the Sun on a new Brookings Institution report, Renewing America's Economic Promise Through Older Industrial Cities. That report argues that Baltimore and other post-industrial American cities, large and small, hold great potential for a more inclusive economic growth that benefits their states and regions. The report puts Baltimore in one of the strongest positions among 70 of the nation's older industrial cities. That's not wishful thinking, but an assessment based on research and analysis by Alan Berube.
I'm a senior fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings in Washington, D.C.
In their report, Alan Berube and his associate, Cecile Murray, offer 75 pages of data and commentary on cities from the East Coast to the Midwest that were once manufacturing hubs. They've had a tough time growing high-quality tech jobs in the digital age, and as a result, they have seen uneven growth. Still, those older cities hold great potential as economic engines that make growth more equitable across race and class. And Brookings says it's time for a new look at cities by decision-makers in state capitals and city halls. Well, having just listened to the audio version of Hillbilly Elegy, which everybody makes reference to nowadays, people say, oh, you got to listen to that in order to understand how Trump was elected. And I was glad to see on page 13 of your report a reference to this, that a lot of the debate about what's going on in the country, why Trump was elected, is framed largely around the plight of rural areas. Let me quote from the report here. Small and remote areas have indeed struggled the most in the post-recession period to regain jobs and income. They were the epicenter of the unanticipated political earthquake that brought Donald Trump to the White House. Questions of what we can do to revive rural America's fortunes thus abound. So someone may ask, why focus on old industrial cities? Right? I mean,
fair question.
Yeah. So what's the proposition here? What are you trying to get at with this report?
Yeah, and it was a big, slightly post hoc motivation for the report. I think we had the idea to do this in the fall of 2016 and started talking to people about it, and then the election happened, and that changed a bit the frame of reference for the report. So yeah, as you're saying, and as we wrote, there's just been a lot of discussion about, you know, I don't know, various guises, the Heartland or the Rust Belt post-election, because this is where so much of the Electoral College swung to Donald Trump. And you know, I'm not a political scientist, right? I study cities and city economies, but I think there's an important economic issue here too, right? Which is that this growing regional inequality, right? This concentration of wealth and jobs along basically the coasts, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the middle of the country getting left behind is really important, because actually that kind of regional inequality can hold back growth, hold back broad-based growth, and as a result sort of fuel resentment, fuel lack of confidence that eventually is a break on economic growth and prosperity. So solving for that regional inequality is really important. But as we wrote, the focus post-election has sort of gone straight to the very most economically distressed small towns and rural communities that voted in the largest numbers for Trump, even though there aren't a whole lot of people who live in these places. because they paint this very stark portrait, right, of maybe a town that lost its factory 25 years ago and has been searching for an economic function since then. So the question becomes, what do we do for these places, right? The proposition of this report is that actually the way that we ought to be looking to create opportunity in the heartland and the Rust Belt is in the cities, that these are actually the places that could be the engines for a broader revival of this large section of the country that is at risk of getting left behind. So the report tries to define what are these places, how are they doing, and what are the assets and the challenges that they have that are going to shape not only their future, but that of the broader region of the country that they represent.
There are four types of older industrial cities that you list here, and you rate them strong, emerging, stabilizing, and vulnerable. Baltimore is in the strong category. We'll deal with that in a minute.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm looking at stabilizing and vulnerable and trying to understand the definitions of those. But that is the heartland. These Flint, Michigan, Rockford, Illinois, Janesville, Wisconsin, Muncie, Indiana, Decatur, Illinois, Kokomo, Indiana, Dayton, Ohio, Youngstown. You know, you are talking about the areas where Trump did well.
Yeah, but I'm originally from just outside of Worcester, Massachusetts, right? Mm-hmm. So that's not, right? That's also sort of in the strong category. It was a manufacturing town when I was growing up. It was losing its manufacturing jobs. My dad worked at U.S. Steel. That plant closed. And there's a lot of resentment in that community, in the broader county in which I grew up, maybe not in the city of Worcester itself, but and all these small towns that, you know, they were mill towns in the 1800s, then the people in those towns were workers at factories in and around Worcester, other parts of the state. You know, there are a lot of those towns that voted for Donald Trump, too. So I guess I wouldn't say that the heartland and the quote-unquote Rust Belt is limited to those iconic places like Flint or Janesville or Muncie that were part of the, you know, really defined by the auto industry. It's a broader set of places that were, you know, at one time the heart of the U.S. manufacturing economy, lost that to the South, to eventually to other countries,
right.
And have struggled to transition to, you know, new kinds of jobs, new kinds of sectors, and are lagging behind the rest of the country on economic prosperity.
So you're saying we need to focus on them. Our best bet, actually, for advancing the economy, broadening progress and prosperity for people, dealing with income inequality, is to focus on these cities, large or small.
Correct. And it's not only about caring about cities and the sorts of people who live in cities. It's an acknowledgement of the economic reality and trying to row with the economic tide rather than against it. The economy is moving to cities. The economy nationally, globally is urbanizing. The economy is expressing a preference for the kinds of environments that cities create. And so I think we can either go along with that and try to channel that energy into more urban places in the United States, or try to, again, you know, row against that tide, reverse that tide, try to restore the economy to very small and remote places. And I just see a much greater chance for success doing the former rather than the latter.
Well, take a minute and tell us what those cities have going for them. I know this isn't just about the Brookings Institute saying, let's support cities because cities are cool. This is not just about this isn't just about that.
Nobody would read that report.
Give me your argument for why we should focus on OICs.
I'd start with the kind of top line numbers. There are already a lot of Americans who live in these places, about 1 in 8 Americans, and the jobs that are there represent about 1/8 of the U.S. economy. So just imagine a collection of cities that, you know, are struggling in some ways, but you put them together, they're almost the size of the state of California as an economy. So just imagine the U.S. economy without California would be a very different economy. Without these cities, it would be a very, very different economy. So there's already a lot going on in these places. But there are a lot of measures that we took, indicators of what we think is important in economy that is changing rapidly technologically, is moving in the direction of urban areas, is diversifying really rapidly, majority-minority workforce within about 25 years is coming our way. And in a lot of these ways, in a lot of these measures, these older industrial places sort of punch either at or above their weight in terms of their research expertise, their research institutions, their innovation measures. They patent at rates that are at or higher than other urban places. They have a lot of STEM talent. They're positioned geographically in an advantageous way in the U.S. economy. They're near a large amount of the U.S. population, consumers and workers. And they have a growing young and diverse workforce that I think can really power their economic growth in the next 20 to 30 years. So I think that these places have a lot going for them. We also spend a lot of time talking about what are the challenges that we need to solve in these places if we're going to make the most of them. But I think they start from a place of greater advantage than our small towns and rural areas do.
So when you list Baltimore, Maryland, along with Worcester, Mass., also seeing there Quincy, Massachusetts, Waterloo, Iowa, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, as strong older industrial cities, it's because they already have a lot going for them. They've recovered better than other places since the recession.
Yeah, that's basically right. We took a measure of the economic performance of these 70 places that we classified as older industrial cities, going back to 2000, so both the pre-recession and the post-recession period, and we assessed how well they were doing on what we call inclusive economic growth. Is the city economy expanding? Is it getting more productive and more valuable? Is it growing good jobs? And are more people getting attached to that opportunity, and are their incomes rising? And among the 70 cities, there were 16 cities, of which Baltimore is one, that were on the stronger side of that continuum. So they were either better off before the recession and then continue that, or they've come out of the recession effectively much more strongly than other cities have.
Are the challenges that these cities face in getting to a better place for their residents and growing, actually, are those challenges political? Are they social? Are they all economic?
Yes, to all of those.
As to all of those, yeah.
We're taking stock of these places as economies, right? Are they growing? Are they getting more prosperous? Are they inclusive in their growth? Are they bringing along most of their population in that growth?
Mm-hmm.
On a number of counts, they have some challenges in the degree to which they are creating good jobs, preparing people for those jobs, enabling people to physically access those jobs. And the solutions for those, yeah, they're about economic strategy, but they're also about taking care of the people who are at risk of being left behind or falling through the cracks, the social safety net. And they're about amassing the political will and balancing these bigger economic questions against the day-to-day issues and crises that a lot of these places face around crime, around fiscal stability. So I don't want to be Pollyannish about, let 1,000 flowers bloom and everything's going to be great in these cities. It's going to take investment and focus over the long term to really make the most of these underlying assets that they have.
You say that it comes down to state and local politics, really. State and local elected leaders or officials pursuing more inclusive economic growth in these older industrial cities.
That's right. And I think Baltimore is one of the most prominent illustrations of that proposition. If you were just to measure Baltimore and its economic health by how its white population is doing, it would look like one of the most successful cities in the country. It has one of the highest rates of educational attainment and per capita income for its white population. It looks a lot like Washington, D.C. when you look at the city's white population. But it's the almost two-thirds of the city's population that isn't white that is really, I think, the key to unlocking broader economic growth in the city, but also write what we call inclusive economic growth, growth that brings all of its populations and communities along. And ultimately, that's what's really important for sustaining the consensus for pursuing growth in cities. If you've got half or two-thirds of the population that isn't actually benefiting from it, why would they support policies that are intended to promote growth and development? If they haven't benefited in the past, you know, why would they support it now? So I think sustaining that consensus democratically actually depends on making sure that everybody's brought along.
So if you were the governor of Maryland, the mayor of Baltimore, the two of you together making an announcement about this, looking at the Brookings report and saying to the public in general in Maryland, you know, actually Maryland is a pretty prosperous state. It sometimes shows up number one in median household income. And yet our largest old industrial city, as you just described, is lagging behind. At least two-thirds of it is. So let's invest here. And here are the reasons why we should do that. The political reality of that is that you're talking to people who live in suburbia and rural areas, some of whom don't care what happens to the city.
Right.
I mean, it's true.
All of the signs of where the national and the global economy are headed, right? All of those signs point very directly toward cities, because that's where the high-value jobs are going. That's where new generations want to live. And it is very hard to imagine over the next 30 years that the Maryland economy as a whole can succeed, sustain its position of economic advantage if the city of Baltimore isn't healthy, because companies are not going to invest in Maryland if there isn't a thriving economic center to the state like Baltimore. Mm-hmm. It's not like Baltimore has nothing to work with either, right? It has a lot of economic assets. It is a research powerhouse. It's got a very dense employment cluster in and around its downtown, actually much more so than most U.S. cities. And it's got an increasingly engaged workforce. There are a much higher share of its adults actually working today than 15 years ago. So I think really the question for the state, and then by extension the city, is around, are we going to prepare people for the jobs that could come to this city and the region if we invest? And are we going to enable people to access those jobs? So I think strategies like really dramatically scaling up work-based learning opportunities for young people, doing a much better job of connecting the neighborhoods, particularly on the west side of Baltimore, to the new and growing job centers in the city and the region. I think we're either going to have a Democratic governor, or Governor Hogan's going to have a second term, or he's term limited out, so maybe just a little bit more freedom to think about the investment agenda and putting urban areas, and particularly Baltimore, at the center of that economic investment agenda. I don't think there's any other way to go if you're thinking about the long-term health of the state.
And again, this is not wishful thinking by Alan Berube and Brookings. This is, you're looking at trends, you're looking at what's already happened in some cities that are showing great signs of success.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at my home state. I'm looking at Massachusetts. Yeah. And of course, you know, Boston is a global economic center today. It's the economy is running hot. But if you had said to me in 1980 that was Boston's future, I was quite young at the time, but maybe if you'd asked my parents, right, they'd have said, you're crazy. Boston is a dying manufacturing city, and we'll be lucky if we don't have to shut off the lights in 20 years.
Yeah, you know what I remember about that era was jobs moving outside of the city.
Oh, absolutely. It was Route 128, right?
Route 128,
all the
right,
jobs,
yeah.
Right. All the jobs are moving to Waltham.
Right.
Natick.
Framingham.
Framingham even, right? But that's not the direction that the economy went. And some of that was, you know, Boston getting its act together, but a lot of it was just, you know, this is what companies saw, what the city had to offer in terms of the environment and the infrastructure and the connectivity and access to those universities. So look what's happened. And now it's beginning to happen to Worcester. It's beginning to happen to even Springfield, Massachusetts. So that state's success is very much predicated on the success of its cities. And I think Maryland and Massachusetts are sort of similar in a lot of ways in terms of their economy, in terms of the talent of their workforces. But to say that, well, Maryland could succeed and we can let Baltimore sort of go its own way, I just don't think there's any, I don't think there's any future in that.
Alan, you've been at this for a while, and there was a report similar to this, what, a decade ago or so, right?
That's right.
So was there an eye-opener for you when you were looking at all this data from the Census Bureau and Moody's Analytics and wherever, all these sources of information,
right,
and data on these cities? Was there a real eye-opener for you in any particular part of the country or a trend that you didn't expect?
Interesting. It's actually not something that I wrote about in the report, ultimately, but was the result of my sort of conversations with leaders in a lot of these kinds of places. I went to the Youngstown area to talk to a group of community leaders. There's pitches. We're going to have a roundtable. We're going to talk about some of the preliminary findings of this report. And so I'm going to Youngstown. I'm thinking about, like, Jim Traficant. I think I'm going to go into a room of old men who smell like cigar smoke,
right.
Are going to talk about Black Monday in 1979 when they shut down the Youngstown steel plant. And almost everybody in the room was under the age of 45. So effectively, they were all younger than me.
Right.
And so most of them grew up around there. Some of them didn't. So they just saw the opportunity to build a community. So I think it's the leadership in these cities. They don't carry the prejudices and the biases of the past in terms of how we think about older industrial places. They see a city, and they see a city with a lot of assets and a city where they can make a mark on the direction of a place. It might be a lot harder to do in a Boston or a Washington, D.C., or a San Francisco. I think that was the most revealing and poignant thing to me about these kinds of places, that, again, you don't really see it in the data, you don't see it in the narrative, but it's real, and it is a mark of, I think, this revaluing of urban America that we see in this coming-of-age generation right now, which gives me a lot of hope and faith for the future for places like Baltimore.
Same here. I mean, I hear this all the time. I see it all the time, and I wish I could bottle it and hand it out all over the place. And because there's fresh eyes, fresh outlooks among the younger people, black and white in Baltimore. A lot of them don't want what their parents had, which is a long commute to work.
Yep.
A home in the suburbs. That's where they grew up. They want to try urban living, and they want the city to work. That's what I sense from them.
Yeah, and I think, again, Baltimore is far from alone in that. And it's not just, the big cities. A lot of these small and mid-sized former industrial places have that same kind of growing energy and outlook. And ultimately, like, the issue of confidence, and confidence in the future of a place, the ability to be bold, it matters a lot. And it probably drives economists crazy because it doesn't fit in an equation very well. But I think it is absolutely necessary for this kind of inclusive economic development that places really need right now.
So it was time to stop and look at these cities again, partly because there's an assumption that cities are doing better than all the rural areas, but they haven't been, actually. That's what the data show. And you're saying you need to take another look at these cities because this is where growth can happen. This is where you can deal with a lot of social problems, too, and solve them, even. Dealing with income inequality, for instance, across the races. There's a lot of potential here. I guess that's what I'm getting from your report.
Yeah, I think that's where we wound up, just sort of thinking about people who live in these places. You know, obviously they get it. They get that making these places healthier is important for they and their families. But there's a broader kind of public out there and pundit and political class that, again, when they're thinking about the issues of "quote unquote" the Heartland or the Rust Belt, there's the fire engine going by.
Don't worry. It happens here at the Sun, too. I don't exactly have a soundproof studio. So
oh, good.
Don't worry about it. Usually that's coming in through my microphone.
No, I'm right on Massachusetts Avenue here. This is main thoroughfare for that kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah, when folks are thinking about the Rust Belt or the Heartland, you know, again, they're just thinking about these very distressed small communities often. Mm-hmm. So we just saw, an opportunity to refocus attention on what remain the real economic anchors of this broad swath of America, these big urban places. And I think also to reframe what it, you know, has been characterized as the plight of the working class coming out of the election, right? And I think often that's just code for the white working class. So we were talking about hillbillyology at the beginning of the program.
Right.
That's important, and you know, we find that actually about 1 in 8 white working class Americans lives in these older industrial cities. So, you know, again, a good chunk of that demographic, but actually 20% of America's substantial black working class lives in these places. So I think it's a chance to solve for not only the economic and demographic challenges of the present, but to think about the more diverse groups whom we need to be an even bigger part of our economic future, because they're a big part of our demographic future, too.
Alan Berube is Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of the Metropolitan Policy Program for Brookings. We've been discussing his new report, Renewing America's Economic Promise Through Older Industrial Cities. You can find a link to that report and my Sunday column on it in the notes with this podcast. That's our show for now. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.